This is Dr. Bob. I live in Syracuse, New York, and I'm enrolled at the Miskatonic University podcast. Go Pods!
It is a center for higher learning. It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls. This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos. Welcome to the Miskatonic University podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University podcast, episode 24. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Murph.
And I'm Keeper Chad. Hello, everyone, and Takalili.
And we are completely without Mr. John and Mr. Dan.
Table for two.
There was long discussions as to whether we should continue. And just for the listener's sake, we decided, yes, we must carry on.
There is a pestilence about. We have two of our hosts are out due to some terrible sickness that is sweeping the country. So,
and it's not a pretty sickness either.
No, it's not. We have had the gory details that we won't share.
I'm going to share a little bit. It's a gastrointestinal issue.
Oh, he said that. Okay.
I did. So gastrointestinal is not bad.
It sounds like gas, though. I don't say gastro again.
Would you rather me say it's a poop problem?
No, definitely not.
Okay, well then it's a gastrointestinal issue. We're cutting the ribbon on our brand new Pickman's Art Institute with special guest and props master Jason McKittrick.
And in our 7th edition segment, this is the last of the series. We're going to talk about chase rules.
And more, but first, let's open up the campus crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
Now, the Campus Crier is Miskatonic U's student paper. Here's where we go through feedback to the podcast and any other news that we need to share.
One thing that we wanted to mention is that this will be somewhat old news by the time this airs, but we wanted to mention
farewell.
A farewell and a respectful eulogy to Lynn Willis, who is a founder of the game. And we will link in the show notes to a number of obituaries on various threads, and we have a thread going on our own. Thank you, Lynn Willis, for all of your work, and we will press on in your memory.
And the cultists have spoken. The voting is in, and the winner is Agmar. This being is a creation of Marcos Sabias, who used Agmar in his Delta Green game, which is had a WSL, which takes WSL to the Dreamlands. Congratulations, Marco. Check out the backstory of a human king in the Dreamlands under a terrible curse.
Yes, congratulations. Honorable mentions to entries that we can't pronounce. There were two.
The second one I can say, but I can't say the first one here.
Right. So Clavo Zenthoi. Sounds kind of, it's like a Greek spelling, mm-hmm. Was another elder god that is a chaotic bundle of multi-dimensional energy ribbons.
And then Plagiarius, maybe, is a mm-hmm. poisonous sharp-toothed larva with a potent hive mind, which is just a terrible thought.
Excellent entries. You really should check out the winner here, Agmar. It's a Delta Green Dreamlands mashup, really kind of a fantastic one.
Agreed.
And we also want to give our heartfelt thanks to the sponsor of the event, Signal Fire Studios, and specifically Jamie Chambers and Ben Mund, who had a hand in designing the game. This is great. A really fun kind of plumbing game turned mythos. And so Marco Subius, you are getting a hard copy of this thing. We had it upgraded, kind of at the last minute. So we will get you your prize.
Wonderful.
from the Miskatonic University Department of History.
In 16th century Europe, during the Renaissance, many wealthy aristocrats collected artifacts from the natural world and displayed them in elaborately designed cabinets as a way to spark wonder and reveal patterns at the core of the universe. They were first called Wunderkammern, or Wonder Rooms. These displays most often encompassed entire rooms and were decorated with specimens of minerals, plants, animals, seashells, coral, religious relics and archaeological finds, sculptures, exotic weapons, medical deformities, as well as many unexplainable things. Their walls were filled with built-in drawers and pigeonholes, boxes within boxes that could be explored for days on end. Many of these rooms were arranged with a focus on aesthetics to suggest the room was a model of the universe, with the human visitor as master of it all in the center. One of the most famous collectors was a Danish physician by the name of Ole Worm, or Olaus Wormius. He gathered a particularly exotic collection in Copenhagen from exploration or trading expeditions of preserved creatures, horns, tusks, and skeletons from hundreds of species, as well as curious human works, amazingly small items, and clockwork automatons like a mechanical duck that was capable of chemical digestion. He studied the cutting edge of optical and experimental devices, and he was a scholar of Nordic runes. He also poisoned his pets and fed them ground-up narwhal horn to prove that it wasn't from a unicorn, since unicorn horns were said to be a universal antidote. Among his collection was a woolly fern specimen that he said was a Scythian lamb, a plant-animal hybrid said to resemble a sheep, which springs from a plant with melon-like seeds that is rooted to the ground by an umbilical cord. It grazed on nearby grasses and on the leaves of its own plant, and then dies. Also known as the vegetable lamb of Tartary, according to Jewish legend, the creature's bones could be used for divination. Some say the legend stems from the discovery of cotton, a plant that appears to grow wool. A German scholar who set out to find the Scythian lamb concluded that the story came from the Persian practice of using the wool of unborn sheep to spin particularly fine thread. Olaus Wormius lived from 1588 to 1654. It's important to note here that the Dominican monk who translated the Necronomicon from Greek into Latin in 1288, whose name is also Olaus Wormius, is clearly a different person because the two are separated by 3 centuries. After his death, a catalog of the Museum Worminaeum was published, and it contained his extensive thoughts on philosophy and science. It's still used as a textbook for scholars of natural history. Later that century, the lavish royal curiosity rooms gave way to more scientific approaches to displays, with less focus on imagination and art, and more focus on taxonomy and instruction. Ole Worm's collection was claimed by Frederick III of Denmark, but this and other exhibits were eventually dispersed to museums and bought up by the bourgeoisie for private collections. Many of the medical oddities and gaffes found their way into traveling circuses for freak shows. One wonders how many of these treasures ended up in the dark, forgotten attics and crawl spaces of the world. For more information on Cabinets of Wonder, stop by the National History Honor Society, where bold speculation is welcome. This lecture is sponsored by the Miskatonic University Department of History.
Another excellent series from Dr. Gerard.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
Now there's only, there's, all right. Well, anyway, a last minute correction though. The duck, the automated duck that can digest things actually happened 100 years after Olaus Wormius had his cabinet of curiosities. So he had automatons, but not that one. I just wanted to correct that. Oops.
Your journalism chops are suffering, I have to admit.
I know. I fact check, you know, after I did it. But in any case, I perhaps obviously picked this particular subject because we're going to be talking about props today.
Yep.
And a lot of the prop, the way that people are making props now are these prop boxes and prop cabinets. And they're drawing directly from this kind of history of gaffes and things that were from the aristocracy, and then they made them their way down into a more democratic populace. And so we're going to be talking about how to make these sorts of things.
Or at least give you some information on where you can go to buy them or figure out if you want to make them yourself.
And how to use them in games.
Yeah, more importantly, how to use them in games, I think.
Okay, make your listen roll. Can I push this roll?
This week we're going to wrap up our coverage of the 7th edition playtest with a discussion of one more proposed mechanic, the chase rules.
Right. Now, we're going to talk about these in more general terms because the actual mechanics are in flux at this point. So we don't want to get too specific because we could be talking about an early draft that's just not relevant. But I think we can talk very briefly about why, whether chase rules are a good idea, how we found them in play, and generally what they're trying to do.
Right. So first off, I guess, with the playtest, Chad, did you have any beefs with the, because I'm not going to go into what the original rules were, because it's pointless. So did you have problems with the playtest rules for chase?
No, I think that what they're trying to do here is to come up with ways to make chase scenes as interesting and dramatic as combat scenes, and they're introducing mechanics that are, you know, sort of as you know, there are as many roles involved. There are combat, it's done in rounds. So I think that what they're trying to do is, encourage ways to make them interesting. And I think it's a really good discussion, even without any mechanics, to have in the book, because it's more Lovecraftian in a way to have your climactic scene be like how your players get away. If you don't have mechanics, to handle that, then it's not as game-ish. You know, there's not as many roles.
Right.
There's not, the dice don't come into play.
It's just like a stating of fact almost, you know?
Yeah. So
you didn't get away.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think generally we can talk about how they're encouraging changes of environment in a chase scene as a way to make it interesting. So, you know, you go down an alley, you say you're in Kingsport, and you go through the fish packing district, so you've got one sort of environment, and then you go down to the docks, and then you have to swim out to a moored boat, and then you have to speed away on the boat to avoid some, you know, incarnation of Igonac or something like that. So that, you know, just finding those beats in a chase scene that help emulate the chase genre, both in film and in books, where it's interesting. It's not just about a straight up movement rate, and there's things to do during the chase.
Now let's talk about, I think that's a brilliant description there of what they're trying to do. And I thought that they captured most of that already in the playtest rules that we saw.
Yeah. Do you remember the playtest?
It wasn't too far off from the original rules in that there was the levels, you know, where you had the stepped levels. And I really don't want to get into it because I think it might have changed.
Yeah.
And that's.
Yeah. I think we talk about the fact that, these changes of scene, might possibly involve different kinds of skills. I doubt that they're going to get rid of that. So that you can creatively think about, you know, you've got, in the example I just gave, you've got, maybe a dex roll to get through narrow streets.
Right.
You've got a con roll. So they were using con rolls as a way to
exhaustion
see if
it, or something of that.
Yeah,
nature.
And to see if maybe your movement might be less.
Right.
If you are exhausted, you might have to rest. But then you know you've got a swim roll, and then you've got a drive boat roll. So you've got like things to do. Not too many, you know, I think it's sort of like one dominant skill per scene.
Right.
Seemed to be the way they wanted to go. And they did introduce a movement rate. We don't know if that's going to stay. That's different than the standard 8. It used to be 8, right, for all human
things. Yeah, I imagine that's one of the hang-ups that are going to probably get changed, to be honest with you. Not that there was an... I'm sorry. I imagine that that's one of those parts of the rule that's going to get changed. Not that there's anything terribly wrong with that, but the fact that there's two different movement rates kind of make things a little difficult.
Right. So we don't know how that's going to shake down. I think they're probably going to try to streamline it. But anyway, like I just support the move to include chase rules, because I think encouraging scenario writers to think through interesting chase scenes, having keepers create good scenes, and putting more emphasis or like equal emphasis on chases as a final climax, as much as the combat, which if you're playing in a Lovecraftian mode, is just going to be how do you die, which can be fun. But the chance to get away, to tell the tale, is quite Lovecraftian, you know, so you can write that diary that gets discovered, you know, 20 years later in an attic. So I support this. I think it shifts the focus a little bit to a horror trope, and I can't wait to see what they come up with.
Yeah, I agree.
So I guess that kind of wraps up our 7th edition coverage. We kind of feel like we shouldn't keep blabbermouthing about it because we just don't know what the final product's going to be like. But I think we've really enjoyed talking about the possibilities, and hope that what comes out will be received by traditional Call of Cthulhu players, as well as those who like some of the new storytelling elements.
Agreed. Yeah, I think that this is a good place to lay to rest, because now we've moved almost exclusively into speculation at this point of the 7th edition rules. So say goodbye, everyone, to the 7th edition segment.
Can I push this roll? So up next, we've got an interview with Lovecraftian artist and prop maker Jason McKittrick. So this is the launch of a new segment that we are calling Pickman's Art Institute.
So this is Keeper Murph from the Miskatonic University podcast, and I'm here with Jason McKittrick, who is better known from the CryptoCurium.com website. Hello, Jason. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good. We were just talking about your the Dunwich Horror, or the Dunwich Cthulhu Idol that you did on the site there. And you do all these, are all your casts in resin? Do you do all your resin casts, or do you use, what is the other stuff, the Ultra C or something like that?
Yeah, there's an Ultra Cal that's used. I personally don't use it. Pretty much everything I do is done from the resin, except for the candy.
Right. Obviously, that is something else that you have on your site that most people don't have, is you've got molded candies. How did you get into that, man?
I kind of just had an idea. It was like 2 Easters ago. I thought of making a Cthulhu idol out of chocolate, because I was looking at the chocolate bunnies on the on the shelf somewhere, and I said they're kind of a similar size to Cthulhu idol, and it was just kind of like, you know, light bulb. And
that's really cool, though. Yeah, those are pretty neat. Are they big? Having never gotten one, I mean, there's the giant one that's like green chocolate, which just scares me to start with.
Yeah, that one's they're all solid. That one's 7.5 inches tall. It's a little over a pound of chocolate.
Good lord, man!
I'll have to send you one so you can try it.
It's not for the diabetics in the audience. That thing's monstrous. Now your site and all of your art is pretty well known. And it all is kind of centered, well, not all of it, but I guess the majority of it has kind of got a serious Lovecraftian bend to it. What got you into the mythos? You know, what brought you into it? Was it the game or the stories or?
I guess I'd have to credit Metallica.
Metallica, no shit. All right, that's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, because they have, you know, the Call of Cthulhu, the one, you know, instrumental guitar piece.
Right.
And then listened to that as a kid. I think I was like 14. I'm in my 30s now. I looked into it, and then I just kind of started reading it, and then never looked back, I guess.
Now, did you get into the role-playing game at all?
Actually, no. I've actually been more familiarized with the gaming aspect after I started doing the art, because I got a few commissions from people who wanted to incorporate it for their gaming and LARPing. So I kind of got introduced that way. I've participated in a handful of games, but I wouldn't say I'm a hardcore gamer.
Well, that's fine. How did you get? How did they find you then to ask you about making props and stuff like that for LARP games?
I got asked to do props for a Lovecraft stage show up in Manhattan. And after I did that, I kind of posted the pieces up on the up on my page, and I had a few Lovecraft pieces already, and then kind of just caught on from there. And then there's Propnomicon, which I think you guys are familiar with. He featured a few, and then from there, I guess everyone kind of caught on. And then from there, I've actually gotten commissions from people actually wanting me to put together basically like a full box of props that kind of like tell a story, so like LARPers could do like a whole weekend based around like a box of items that I made, which is pretty cool too.
That's crazy. So what were you doing? What kind of art were you doing before you got into the Mythos stuff?
I've always been kind of into it, but professionally I was an illustrator. That's what I went to school for. I started doing work for a museum in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and they had me do this kind of like fake exhibit where they wanted to say, hey, the Jersey Devil exists. here's the proof. So I made all these fake specimens and a fake Jersey Devil skull and all that, and then I kind of, all the stuff that I did from that, and I was like, oh, I want to do some, make those pieces, and then kind of arrived out of that, I guess.
That's awesome. How many new works do you put out? Because you put out a lot of stuff, man. Honestly, you put out more than most people do. How much do you come up with? I mean, how do you have the time? First off, that's what my main question is.
I don't know. That's actually something people ask me. I'm married. I have two small kids, and I work, and then I do this. So it's kind of just what I do, and I get it my obsession because. I don't sit down and watch, sports or, do anything that's really consuming like that. So this is what I do to kind of like, this is my hobby thing. So.
Right. No, I'm totally with you there. I'm in the same boat I'm in the same age group. I've got three small children at home and I work and then I do this on the side, because I just love doing this kind of stuff and it's a lot of fun. So I can relate to that at least.
It's just been gaining momentum. Every year I do more. I mean, this last year I put up 42 pieces, and that's double from the year before. And it's kind of been like a demand thing because every time I do one, I turn around and there's another email or someone else asking, oh, could you make this for me or whatever. And then when I started doing the resin casting, that's been insane. Like I haven't stopped doing it since last year now.
Wow. How many mold? I mean, when you make a mold of a new item, how many do you typically make of that? How many resin casts do you make of that item?
I usually, what I'll do is I'll make a few and then I'll post them.
Right.
And then I'll give a designated amount of time where they can order it. Let's say in like a 3-day weekend or something.
Right.
And then once that 3-day weekend is closed, then I'll make them. So like, for example, I did a, from the sale that you got, the Dunwich Cthulhu idol, that one I sold a little over 200 of those idols.
Wow.
So, it's been great. I mean, I've gotten a great response from, the Lovecraft community on the whole. So it's pretty great.
Yeah. They're great. They're really cool. Just idols. The idols you do are fantastic, but I mean, the really cool stuff you have are the amulets and the medallions. Like I have the Crawling Chaos amulet, which is just freaking fantastic. The detail on the tentacles there in the face are just unbelievable. And then that big Cthulhu cultist medallion that you have, which is like, I don't know how big that is, but it looks huge in the picture.
It's about like 4 inches across.
Yeah. See, that's pretty big. And then the horror in clay you have, that plaque like, piece, that wall plaque, they're just awesome. I mean, they're not. At first, I was thinking, well, these make good game props, but the hell with that. I'm hanging this shit on my wall. You know what I mean? This stuff is just great. I can't get by it. between, and there's some guys out there that just do some fantastic work. There's you and Oakry, like you mentioned, from over at Propnomicon, and Joe Browers. But I mean, it's yeah, and it's, y'all just churning out such amazing stuff that I thought it would be, you know, it'd be remiss to have a podcast about, you know, the gaming aspect of Call of Cthulhu and not actually mention the prop making and stuff like that, because I mean, this stuff is so awesome. But you know, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's cool. And it's so much better when you can just hand somebody something, you know, like, oh, here's the pages you find, or here's the book. I knew I had one guy who made up a whole damn book once, you know, but it, you know, it's a lot of fun. You know, I really enjoy it. We got a treat for you, for the listeners today, because Jason was kind enough to actually allow us to go through a small tutorial of how to make a page from the Necronomicon. And if you look on the website, we'll have in the show notes for today, we'll have the links to the PDFs that you can use to, that are the front and back image of the Necronomicon page that we'll be doing. Now, first, obviously I need to print this out, and we're going to print it double-sided, and don't print it upside down like I did the first time, because it looks retarded at that point. But so I've gotten my page printed. And what do I do at this point?
After you get the page printed, you want to get you got to brew yourself a pot of coffee. You know, or go to Wawa or Dunkin' Donuts, get some coffee, and you want to fill up a like a square pan, something that's going to be able to submerge the whole paper in coffee. And once you do that, you want to let it sit there in a few minutes. The longer you let it sit, the darker the color it'll be when it dries. But you can't let it go in too long, you know, longer than, I would say, 5 minutes, because after that, the paper is going to start to get too soggy and the ink might run.
Right, okay.
So after that, after it sits, I'm sorry, Ken.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying, after that, you're going to pull it out of the coffee, put it on like a paper towel or something, and then you're just going to get a blow dryer, hopefully you have one, and you're just going to even until it's nice and dry, and it should have a nice kind of crinkly look to it afterwards.
Yeah, I'm going to admit that I didn't use a blow dryer, mainly because I was in the kitchen and I didn't feel like walking to the other side of my house. And I looked in front of me and I had this brilliant microwave there. And so I threw the page, I threw this sopping wet page in the middle of my microwave and nuked it for about a minute and a half. And it actually did a pretty good job.
Actually, that's actually what I'll do most of the time, but I just wanted to kind of stay safe because I don't know how safe that is. It hasn't burned down my house yet, but.
No, I was thinking the same thing. A couple of places on here, it looks like where the plate was beneath it kind of burned some of the imperfections into the page, which made it look kind of neat. And I was like, wow, that looks pretty cool. So I was like, well, you know, I mean, that's a shortcut way to it instead of holding a hair dryer to it for 15 minutes or something.
Right. After that, what you want to do, you'll see on the image, there's a border around the edges, but it only goes around three sides.
Right.
What you want to do is the side that doesn't have borders, you want to rip that edge so it kind of has a look that this page has been torn out of the Necronomicon.
That's a brilliant idea. Okay.
And once you do that, you want to get some sandpaper, and you can go ahead and sandpaper the edges of it. You know, you can tear it, and then just kind of like give it a good once over on all four sides. And that could give it a nice, that'll give it a nice aged look. You can also, if you want, you can fold it in half and then sandpaper on the corners. Also give it fold it up in another book for a couple centuries or whatever.
Oh, I get it. To make it look like it's been folded up forever and hidden away or something. That's a pretty good idea.
Right. So, and then other than that, that's pretty much it for the prop. I mean, you can play around with, if you want, you can play around with how much coffee you put on there. You can also play with the strength of the brew. If you do a really dark brew of coffee, it'll be extra dark. And if you also want to play around with the microwave, which can be fun, you can put the page in the microwave, and you can sprinkle a little bit more coffee on the top of the, you know, like drops or whatever on the page itself. And those darker areas will bake in at a darker color, and it'll look like, you know, water stains or mold.
Oh, crazy. That's cool. What about, I've heard people doing something similar. Instead of coffee, they use tea. Now, do you have a preference or?
Tea works no problem, but coffee works faster.
There you go. All right, that's what I needed. Speed is of essence here.
Yeah, crash course.
Yeah, no kidding, right? So, all right, so I've got this page. How do you do stuff like, How? What else can I do to this to make it look? Is there a way to? Well, no. Let me back up. Does the paper make a difference? Like, if I use like some really heavy cardstock or some heavy like calligraphy paper that's really absorbent, what kind of difference is that going to make?
Yeah, it'll make all the difference. I'm glad you brought that up. White paper, of course, will work fine, but you can get any number of kind of papers that's going to, obviously will go through your printer. You can use, for example, what I used for this one, and I'll age a page, and, that everyone can see that I did, so everyone can see for the example. I used a parchment type paper, so it has a nice kind of texture to it already.
Right.
And then use that, and then that coupled with the coffee gives a real, nice dark texture to it.
Cool. That's an awesome idea. Now, what about if I wanted to make one that looked like vellum, that heavy, thick parchment, lambskin? I mean, is it possible to do that?
You could do that. Yeah, you could do it, but not really because once you get to heavier papers, it's going to be harder to put it through your printer.
Right.
Then there's something you go on. I've tried with heat transfers, but that's a whole nother.
Yeah, that's a whole nother issue. We won't get into heat transfers. Not right now.
Right.
That's almost like setting molds and stuff. We're not going to go into that right now. That's awesome, Jason. I really appreciate the help there. We'll have some pictures of yours and mine. I made the same thing. I actually burned the edges of mine. Is that allowed? I mean, I figured I could go crazy with it, right?
Yeah, sure. No problem. It kind of reminded me of like grade school projects when you had to make the Declaration of Independence and, you burn the edges with the light.
Right, exactly. I was like, come on, what the hell am I doing? I'll burn it. That's what I'll do. But, what the hell? I mean, what else are we going to do with it? Have you got anything new coming out on the website that we want to talk about?
I actually have, like 5 or 6 things, ready to go. First up, it's actually a first for us that we're going to be doing. It's going to be called the Crypticurium Inner Sanctum, and it's basically a membership. And what this membership will afford the people who decide to join is exclusive sculptures, a Crypticurium t-shirt, a notebook, and stickers, all featuring Cthulhu and a few other things. We're going to have all the details up for that other than the next 2-3 weeks. And we're going to have a few different levels of membership. We'll have a bronze, a silver, and a gold level. And what that'll do is we're going to have 3 sculptures that are going to come out throughout this coming year. And first one's going to come up in the next month or so. And if you're a bronze member, you'll get just that sculpture, and you'll get a t-shirt. If you're a silver member, you'll get the first sculpture, then the second one that's going to come out in a few months, plus the t-shirt and a couple other goodies. And then obviously gold member is going to get all 3 of the sculptures, plus the t-shirt, plus a couple other goodies, and a customized Arkham Sanitarium patient file with their own picture.
Oh, that's crazy. And now, what are the price levels? Or are you willing to say?
I'll give you a ballpark for now because I haven't finalized the everything that's going to go in them, but probably going to be around like bronze is going to be 100, probably silver probably 200, and gold will probably be 300.
Right.
So, and any sculptures that are available are only available to members of the Inner Sanctum. So.
Cool. And are they going to be like the size of your idols, which is about 4 and a half inches tall? Are they going to be bigger? Or?
Yeah, there's probably going to be an idol in there. I'm working on another piece that's going to depict the, it's going to be kind of like a bas relief style, kind of like the horror in clay, but it's going to depict the battle of Cthulhu and his spawn against the elder things and the Shuggets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's going to probably be the second or the third one to come out.
And what style are you going to do that in, just out of curiosity? Because they all seem to have a certain, like the Crawling Chaos Amulet is kind of got a Egyptian motif to it, and the Cthulhu artifact is kind of like a Mayan almost sort of feel to it.
Right. If you were to look on the website, if anyone wants to take a look, go back on my website. There's a piece called the Eskimo Cthulhu Fetish, which when I came up with it, I kind of had the idea that it was one of the sculptures that had broken off from the Elder Thing City in Antarctica. So the big bas relief sculpture that's going to be coming out with the battle war scene on it. I'm imagining that it's from those same wall sculptures that they describe in At the Mounds of Madness. So it's going to be in that similar style. It's going to be a...
It's going to be a paired set for the Eskimo Cthulhu fetish, then. It's going to match up to that. Sort not the exact,
yeah, it'll
not exactly,
close.
But it's going to be part of that same section of wall, so to speak.
Yeah, it's going to be close stylistically. But then beyond that, I have a couple other things coming up. I have a another whole prop set coming up that's based on the Dreams in the Witch House, which that should be coming out in about 2 weeks. It's a one of a kind. And then there's probably maybe a couple months down the road, me and Joe Browers, the artist, are actually working on a joint project together, which we're pretty excited about. So that'll be coming out soon.
Awesome. Now, what kind of stuff do you put in those the prop packages there? Is it similar to like HPLH's Professor, what's his name, box from Call of Cthulhu? I can't remember his name. Professor Angel?
Somewhat similar, but mine are more focused on the sculptural aspects of them all.
Right.
So, for example, if you were to look on, I'll send you a link. I have, like last year, I did a whole box of things that belonged to Joseph Kerwin, the necromancer from Charles Dexter Ward.
Right.
So it's going to be kind of like that. These are going to be items that were found in the witch house, things that belong to Mason.
That's awesome.
A little dome, glass dome piece that has the skull of Brown Jenkin in it, and a few other cool things coming out soon.
That's so cool. And what are you and Joe doing together? Can y'all say yet, or give me a hint or something?
It involves At the Mountains of Madness.
Oh my gosh! Okay, that's enough then. Because you do some really awesome, I guess, like your bas relief and your, you know, your idols are awesome. And then Joe does some really cool figurines and stuff that are just off the hook. And I can't imagine the two of them combined. I don't know what the hell y'all come up with.
Yeah, we're working on it now. We talk quite a bit and we're collaborating. I mean, we're separated by just a few miles, so. So.
Now, what? Okay, I'm going to ask you some stupid questions now, okay, man? Because I have tried this shit with making like the specimens in a jar thing, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, I can never. I mean, I'm not stupid, but I cannot make. I just don't have a talent for it. I guess is what it comes down to. I can't make it look believable. Like I can make a cartoonish looking thing, but I can't make it look frightening by any means.
Right.
What the hell am I doing wrong? I mean, is there some step that I've missed that I'm just not doing, or?
Well, as far as trying to make something look good, I mean, you're honestly only as good as the reference that you have. So, you know, you gotta get a good piece of reference of whatever you're gonna try to do. So, if you're gonna like give this thing like nasty looking eyeball or some kind of like gangly teeth or something, you know, go on the internet, find some good photo reference, and then you know try to recreate that.
And does it make a difference on like the tools that you use? Because like I mean, they'll try and sell you like all kinds of crazy spatulas and fucking.
I use what's basically a pointed piece of wood, and that's all I've ever used. I like carving tools. I guess. I mean, I don't personally. I use one tool for everything.
So okay. So like on this Dunwich idol. Right. Okay. Is this a blob of Sculpey, or did you put this? Is this two pieces or more of Sculpey? Like the base is one, and then the idol is a second one, or how? Or like, did you make the little tentacles on its face, or did you apply them after the fact and smooth them in? I mean, that's the.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, at first I did the block on the bottom, and then I did a rough sculpt of the figure, and then I plopped the figure onto there. And then I kind of added the feet and hands and tentacles. And then
you added those separate.
To make it interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. And then how do you get that weird texture? I mean, that because you've got this strange. It seems like a lot of your stuff has this strange texture, almost like
it's a trade secret.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. You're not going to tell me, are you? Because that it's really odd when you get it. It's got a lot of feel to it. You know what I mean? It's not like a.
Yeah,
just a smooth piece of resin or anything. I mean, it's got like texture to it. It makes it feel like it's a real piece of stone, you know?
Yeah.
Don't tell me.
If you're going to try to sculpt something, I'll give you a little tip. Try pressing textures into the clay. Like maybe go outside and get a piece of bark and press the bark into the clay.
Oh, that's a good idea. I never would have thought of that.
That's not exactly what I do, but that'll get you started.
There you go. That's fair enough. All right, man.
Actually, it's funny you say, I'm sorry.
No.
I was going to say, because you said bottled specimen, I was going to say, that was actually my first idea to do as a little prop project. I was like, I don't know how many people are going to actually do it, and maybe it might be too complicated. So if we do another one, I'd be happy to do one of those.
Oh, look. Hey, is that stamp on the back of this Cthulhu artifact the same stamp that's on your cover of the book? The Dream
Journal? Yeah, it's the same one. That's actually going to be what's going to be on the t-shirt that you get if you join the Inner Sanctum.
Oh, sweet. Okay. And it's going to be called the Inner Sanctum?
Yeah, the Cryptotrium Inner Sanctum.
Cool. When do you think you're going to have that out? I mean, when can I talk about it? Let's put it that way.
It's going to happen this month.
Oh, this month. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, this is actually, and I say we, which is just, it's me and my wife who do this.
Well, I was going to ask you kept saying, well, we do this and we do that. I was like, man, it looks like you alone, but is there somebody, you have a staff? Are you that big now?
No, it's just me and my wife. It's basically me doing all the artistic stuff. My wife will help me do, like, you know, paperwork stuff and box stuff up. And, like, you know, we have, like, our jam sessions where we, like, you know, have to box up, like, 300 boxes in a night kind of stuff.
Holy shit, man. I wish I was closer. I'd help, dude. That's just awesome. Just to be able to see all that shit turn out. Now, how did you get into, like, where did you learn how to do the molds and stuff like that?
I mean, taught myself.
You taught yourself? You're all self-taught. I mean, yeah. Did you do, like, we'll use this Dunwich Cthulhu because I've got it in front of me. Is this thing made this in Sculpey first or something similar?
The original is Sculpey.
Right.
And then you bake it. And then you make from that big sculpture, you make a mold of.
Right.
And then, you know, you take the mold, you know, you take the piece out of the mold, and then you pour the liquid resin into the mold. It hardens, comes out, and then it has a two-step paint process.
That's really awesome. So how long does it take you to whip out one of these things?
Well, I have, like, the Dunwich one, I think I need four molds for, so I could do four at a time. So, you know, I could probably crank out, like, in a day, I probably could crank out, like, 40 of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty good, though. I mean, that's still a couple of hours, but you've got four molds rolling.
Yeah. That's the best part of it. And, you know, and that's usually the way that I have to do it is, you know, like I was saying to you before, I take the orders first and then I make them because
right.
I don't know what's going to be popular and what's not.
Yeah, you don't want to get stuck with, you know, 300 Dunwich Horrors on the shelf and nobody buying them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's...
That'd be an odd Christmas gift for the next 5 years, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Again? Uncle Jason, oh my God.
Well, they know how weird I am already, so it's
Oh, me too, man. Believe me.
No, it kind of, and that way of selling stuff actually worked out better for me because, you know, it kind of has this, like, oh, limited time only kind of thing and kind of, like, lights a lot of fire under people's ass to, you know, buy.
I know. And that's, like, one of the guys on the show, Dan, mm-hmm. He actually mentioned that, like, his favorite piece, let me find the email, because he was like, my favorite piece is this one he does that's from the one that you did right over the apocalypse, you know, I think it was the Mayan. Yeah, the Mayan one.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. The Mayan one, that was awesome. And he was like, but it was only 3 days, and I couldn't get it. And I was like, you stupid bastard. I'm sorry. You know what? I mean, what do you do? But no, it makes it awesome, because then it's like, you know, they're limited edition almost by default at that point. So it's really cool. Have you ever, like, what do you do with the molds? Like, for that Arkham Cthulhu idol, which, you know, obviously is not available anymore. What do you do with the mold? You keep it?
Yeah, I still got them. If we do events, I'll bring some to events and say, hey, guys, you know, I got some of these with me that are not available for the site anymore. If you want to come to the event, come get them. Are you going out to Necronomicon in the summer?
Man, I'm trying. My problem is I got three kids and I live in Texas. You know what I mean?
I hear you.
So I'm in, you know, I'm out. It's a long damn trip for me. That's a day of travel minimum. There's another buddy of ours who, if you're listening to the show, Dr. Gerard, Chad, and I've thought about taking the shuttle to, the plane shuttle, you know, driving with him in a rental car up to Rhode Island, which is like an 8-hour right. drive. So, right. I mean, that's like 2 hours of travel or 2 days full of travel.
Well, I think it's going to be worth it though.
it's just, if I can afford the hotel and all of that, then yeah. I'm good. You know what I mean? That's what I'm hoping for. I really, really want to go. I don't want to miss it, but you know how life is.
Yeah, I know. Well, I was just going to say, if you make it out there, I'm definitely going to be there. So,
are you going to be selling there? Are you going to have a booth or anything?
I got in contact with them early on because they, when they started doing their Kickstarter thing,
right?
Which just ended a couple hours ago. I said, hey, I'll donate some stuff. And so I gave them 10 of my, they're called the Arkham Cthulhu idols. I sold them on HP's birthday.
Right.
In August. I said, you know, hey, I'll give you 10, do whatever you want to do with them. And they ended up using them just today, as like a, hey, last ditch effort, you know, trying to get as much money as they can get in. And they got rid of all of them. So I was like, wow. Okay, I guess I got to give you all 10.
I'll strip them out next like, week.
Yeah, and that was for like a $250 donation.
Wow, so, that is nuts, so, dude.
It's a crazy thing, though, because it's like there's like a little like Lovecraft renaissance happening right now.
Right, there is.
Like, people are starting to talk about it a little bit. Like, it's kind of like, I don't know how to describe it. But it's almost like there's like this Lovecraftian kind of like hipster thing happening.
Oh, yeah, it's the in crowd now. It's Lovecraft, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, oh, what's this thing that nobody really knows about yet? Oh, he's even more obscure than Stephen King. It's like, what? But it's like, you know, here's all these fans, you know, they're like, oh, it's an author nobody, you know, knows about. Perfect. So, yes, it's this thing that, you know, everyone's like.
Yeah, and then they run into us. That's the thing.
Everybody knows comics now, so it's not even cool to be a comic book nerd anymore.
Right.
You know, which I grew up in.
Right,
so
me
now
too.
It's like, oh, what's the, you know, so.
No, I hear you. It's like the new genre or the new fad for nerdy guys, you know, and girls.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the new thing to be. Yeah. Like, I was a comic book nerd and an RPG nerd, and now they're all Lovecraft nerds. It's really weird, you know, because nobody knew what the fuck I was talking about when I was, you know, quoting Dexter Ward or something in high school. You know,
right.
I thought I was nuts. I was like, I'm fine with that. I'm nuts for sure. But it's wild, man. The people, the amount of stuff that seems to pop up nowadays, it's really wild how much of this is just popping up out of nowhere.
Yeah, no, and I think it's cool because, like, you know, guys like you who are doing the show, like, you have all these new people coming in that want to know about Lovecraft, and then, you know, you got you guys who are obviously seasoned at it, and like, oh, these guys sound like they know what the fuck they're talking about, so then they, you know, they jump on your show.
We try to sound like we know what we're talking about.
Oh, man, I was listening to your show because I know just the stories, and like, I don't even deviate from Lovecraft. Like I don't read any of like Derleth.
Oh my! Yeah, okay, yeah, I would. I'm honestly, I'd stay away from Derleth, right? But there are so many other guys that he wrote with at that same time period that made just some really awesome short stories that are worth reading. But they're they all tie together, and it's really cool. You know, Robert Bloch's, and then there's a guy named T.E.D. Klein, or I always call him Ted Klein, who was like a protege of Lovecraft. He wrote some really awesome short stories. But a lot of these guys just kind of like died and went off to nowhere land. You know, they just don't hear about them.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, you know, I guess they kind of saw what happened to Lovecraft. They're like, oh, don't want that happen to me. Let's try something else.
Right. Or they didn't, and they just stayed in that undercurrent of the weird fiction genre, which pretty much died and has come back now. I think that's part of that Lovecraftian renaissance we're seeing is the weird fiction, return of weird fiction in general, which seems to be, it's a really cool thing. I like weird fiction personally. So, you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, like, yeah, I've just been sticking with, you know, the pure Lovecraft stuff just because, I don't know, I just like, kind of feel like, it's like, I just want to stick with the Lovecraft, which I do, and it's, you know, it's great and all. But, no, it's very, very interesting to see that, you know, people are kind of like coming around and wanting to see, you know, what this Lovecraft thing is all about. You know.
Now, you're actually in New Jersey, right?
Yeah.
How did Hurricane Sandy affect you at all? I mean, did that put a big hurt on you there, or did you get through it with unscathed? Or
Luckily, we got through pretty unscathed. I mean, we actually are in like the ground zero section. I mean, I live about 5 miles from Seaside Heights. So, which was like, I don't know if you saw pictures, the roller coaster that was like in the water and all that, that's about 5 miles from here. So we were actually okay. There's no damage. We were without power for about 6-7 days.
Right.
So, but other than that, I mean, there's a couple lost packages because the mail was in chaos for about 3 weeks here, but other than that, we're all right.
Well, that's no big deal. That's worth it, you know, if that's all that you had happen. I was actually, I lived down on the east coast of Texas. Southeast Texas,
okay.
And we got hit by several hurricanes, but the last one was Hurricane Ike, and I said, the hell with this, after I lost my house and everything in it, and moved a little north to get out of the flood zone, basically. But we had about 8 or 9 feet of water come through, a huge storm surge, and it people don't realize how devastating that can actually be until you actually sit through it and have to sift through all the crap and try and put your life back together. It's really a devastating thing.
Oh yeah, it's unbelievable. My brother actually works on one of the cleanup crews.
And no, that's just the worst.
You know, houses that are just gone.
Yeah, that's the worst, man.
Unbelievable.
The cleanups is what I couldn't do it. I tried to do it and it just tears me up. I just could not go through with it. I don't know how he can do it on a regular basis. It just gets to me too much, I guess. But anyway. Anyway, that's pretty much it, I guess. Thank you very much for talking.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Really appreciate it.
All right. Yeah, that's must sound like a really fun interview, actually.
Oh, it was. We had a lot of fun.
Well, this is, so what we're going to do with this Pickman's Art Institute is talk about props in a kind of rolling series. And we've already got some other folks lined up to talk to, because props are such an important part of this game, like the culture of this game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have with D&D, you have the minis and the painting, you have the dungeon tiles and map making and all these
right.
kind of crafty things. But in this game, it's the clues that you give out and the props. And there's a real tactile, it's almost like a special effect to me. Like it engages another sense. You pass something around the table. And since we're talking to new keepers, this is our way of kind of drawing them into that part of the hobby.
Yeah, agreed. It's a very important part of the game itself, at least it always has been for me. Less so here lately because we do the even more so lately because we do the Skype games, and
yeah.
We still do the handouts. We still have handouts. They're typically in PDF format now, but they're mm-hmm. no less impressive.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots of things you can do digitally to you know, kind of show an aged document,
mm-hmm.
even on Skype games. But man, if you're doing a meat space game and you are able to bring out, you know, sculptures and three-dimensional stuff. And,
oh, yeah. There's no comparison to that.
Oh, man. And it really signals to your we may be getting ahead of ourselves here, but it signals to your players that you have put in some time. And so I think it helps to bring your players in and immerse them and give them a sense that you're serious about the game. You take it. You put some work into it and that they may step up to the plate as a result.
Right. And as a worthy example of that, way back in the heyday, you know, in the 80s of Call of Cthulhu, they did the Cthulhu Masters Tournament. And there's a particular game called No Man's Land that was actually played at Cthulhu Masters. And the game was ran in a room that was done up to look like a trench office, you know, like an underground office, where the keeper was in garb as a World War One officer.
Yeah.
And then he had a second keeper that was helping him out. That was like his runner, dressed like a runner. And they had, it was done by lantern light. They went all out on the props, on the setup, the ambiance, and that kind of all falls within the same, general, heading, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to ask you, man, I know that you are a budding prop maker, like myself. And, so do you have a particular prop that you want to talk about how you made and how you used it in game?
I'll be honest, most of the props that I've made are paper props. So I've mainly taken handouts that are in scenarios that are published scenarios. Mm-hmm. And then I'll print that page out or copy that page as it used to be. And then doctor up that page to make it look like it was much older than, what it is, which means that, you know, because it's new. So I'm trying to make it look aged in some form or fashion.
Yeah, that's great. You know, like, Miskatonic River Press has had, a couple of books come out where they will actually have the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Right. Do up some digital props, and you can go on the site and download them for free.
Yeah.
And then so you've already got it kind of set up, and they will walk you through like, okay, this one ought to be maybe on cardstock because it's from, you know, a heavy book. And
right. Here. There's no one compares to HPLHS, with their paper prop stuff. I mean, their stuff is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And they give a lot of really helpful tips for people who want to, incorporate those, correctly into their games.
Yeah. I've had some fun lately with, Sculpey, and we'll talk.
Yeah. Sculpey's so awesome.
It's so versatile. You can bake it, you know, you can half bake it so that it's still a little bit flexible, or you can, you know, harden it up. You can make molds out of it. So then you can actually start to make, you know, Sculpey molds for other Sculpey.
Yeah.
Not for resin,
but for Sculpey.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's a good starter way. So get yourself a brick of Sculpey, I recommend, and just start playing.
Yeah. And some of the Super Sculpey and Sculpey Ultra and stuff like that actually comes colored. So you can get the, you know, in different colors, whereas old school, you'd have to paint it or dye the Sculpey. And that's not the issue anymore. You can actually just get it pre-colored, and some of them even are metallic now, so you can get like this metallic red color.
Pearl is a nice color.
It's really cool that you can get all these different colors, and it costs a little bit extra to get the metallic versions, but you know, it makes life a lot easier in the long run.
One little tip that I wanted to mention is you can take two colors. What I like to do is take black and make the kind of innards of a creature.
Right.
And then use, either the glowing one is a little bit, translucent. And there's also a translucent color. And you take that and stretch it out as a skin and just like make it as thin as possible. Oh, and then what happens is, you get like, you can kind of like a wood grub. I don't know if you've ever seen a beetle grub that you can see its guts.
Yeah.
As it moves along, so that way you have this like multi-layered.
Oh, that's cool. I like that
effect. Yeah,
that's cool. It's almost like a desiccated corpse, you know, in that it's
can do. Yeah,
you know, the skin is so thin that you're seeing, you know, the rotting innards there.
Exactly. Stress it up a little bit with a fork or whatever you have on hand.
Yeah. That's something we'll go into later, I guess, whenever we get into, specifically into Sculpey stuff. And I guess maybe since Jason's, tutorial was kind of centered on, was about a paper prop. Maybe we should just stick to paper props for this episode so that we don't go so broad, you know?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I like to do is go on archive.org.
Right.
And look at some of the old tomes that they have.
Yeah, because they have a lot of old, archived text that are scans, book scans, document scans.
Look up alchemy and you'll just look, you know, and you find all these alchemy books with great visuals and frontispieces. And you can doctor them up in Photoshop if you want to go advanced, or you can just pull those out as individual pages. And I think on the site I already have on the forum, I have a way, you know, I've spelled out a way to make a booklet out of it, going to Kinko's, which makes booklets. So yeah, you can actually have a kind of stand-in book prop that people can flip through. And, you know, you can even doctor it up with India ink, make annotations for your clue or something like that.
Chad actually sent me for Christmas. I have a couple of little books that he made up, and they look great. One of them is the an epistle from John Moore, the apothecary of Aberch Lane to somebody, you know, a treatise of worms. And then the other one is, let me open it up real quick because it doesn't have a title on the front. The other one, I don't know what the hell it is. I can't read Latin. That's what it's called. Oh, I can't read Latin. a system of magic by somebody. I don't know, but it's freaking awesome looking. And it's obviously a tome that you found online somewhere that you printed out the pages individually and then hand stapled them together to make a little mini booklet. And it's fantastic, man. It looks great.
Yeah. Actually, System of Magic is one of the occult books that Daniel Defoe made.
Right.
And so he's the guy that, that did Robinson Crusoe and was kind of an early, he was on the frontier of making novels, you know, one of the first novelists that we have in the English language. And he has three of them. And so you can actually make kind of a Book Hounds campaign out of just his works. There may be, you know, specialized collectors or that kind of thing. That's what I did in a campaign with these. But it was so easy because they're free. Right. You know, it's open source. The covers are scanned. So you actually have a kind of texture that you can print on a, you know, resume paper or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, so even though it's not a bound book, it kind of gives that sense of a bound book, and it's pretty cheap to make.
Yeah. I mean, you are quote unquote binding it. At least you're stapling it together in a folded right. over page version. So, I mean, it's a little booklet, you know, it's held together.
So anyway, that's our Pickman's Art Institute. We also have a forum thread for this. Check it out on the forum. We'll link to it. We want to get a discussion about craftiness, and those of you who make these things, let's trade, secrets, you know, tips and that kind of thing. And also, link to some of these artists who make fantastic work that you would be lucky if you could, even emulate.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah, so give them a kind of a forum to talk about their work, because there's not one central place that's a kind of an ongoing conversation. So highly recommend that you ask questions of our experts.
Please, please. Yes, and Jason's actually a member over there, as well as a couple other artists who have shown up. And hopefully this will be a spot for, you know, Mythos artists in general to come and hang out. Evidently, there's not a place like that currently. There's not a forum dedicated to that sort of thing. So I figured, well, we can fill that hole.
All right, now let's take a short break for a word from one of our sponsors.
My goodness, it's blowing like mad out there. Please put the kettle on for us, Jimmy.
Sure thing, Professor. I really appreciate you taking me along on this research trip, Professor. I never expected to be able to do anything like this. Especially after that last incident in Whately Hall.
Yes, well, the board decided that it might be best to remove you from the public eye for a few weeks. I do hope you learn to do the proper research when summoning Shoggoths.
Oh, without a doubt, Professor. I'm leaving the Squamous ones alone.
Quite right. Now, bring me the latest samples, will you? We might as well try and see if these pieces we found will fit together.
Oh, I went ahead and started while you were out, Professor.
You did what? I thought we agreed that you wouldn't...
Oh, Professor, what could it hurt? The pieces are frozen solid.
Well, yes, I see the shards are all in place. Great Scott, it seems to be some kind of giant winged lizard. Where is the head?
Oh, I'll get it.
Now, while he's looking for that, I might as well perform some extra research using the service I found on my Google machine called audible.com.
I'll just put this last sample in place.
By signing up, I got a free month of service and one free audiobook that I can keep forever. Not only that, but by going to www.mu-podcast.com/audible, I was able to support my favorite podcast.
Giant seahorse with wings?
With my headphones covering my ears, I've transported to another world as I listen to my favorite novels.
Willikers, it's glowing.
Ah, an Agatha Christie BBC radio drama? Don't mind if I do.
Something probably terrible is happening now.
Hercule Poirot? Such an odd little Belgian genius.
It seems like it's coming to life. Professor!
Oh, Jimmy. What have you done this time? Just hold on, Jimmy. If you'd have paid attention during the pre-mission briefing, you would have realized that Shandhaks, of which these are undoubtedly, are negatively influenced by our yellow sun.
It has made its horrible alpha-9 talons!
do something, man!
That rather important information, coupled with the vast containment field that we set up before you arrived, should put an end to another of your glorious mishaps. Just let me activate the magic circle with this elder sign.
I just get so sleepy and...
Ah, you see, Jimmy, the Shantak loses all strength when faced with the spectrum of light emitted from our sun. That was something you would have realized had you not been sleeping in class.
Oh, sorry, Professor. I guess I messed up again, didn't I?
Not at all, Jimmy. Mistakes will always happen. And besides, I'm pretty sure you and I are not on the same team.
What did you say, Professor?
Oh, nothing, Jimmy. I tell you what, why don't you listen to Jim Fleming's audiobook, To the Best of Our Knowledge, Astrobiology? That will be like a refresher course for you, okay?
Sure, Professor. I think I might go see a doctor first, though.
Nonsense, Jimmy. That yurt broke your fall quite nicely. Remember, Jimmy, www.mu-podcast.com/audible will get you a free trial and support your favorite podcast. That's www.mu-podcast.com/audible.
And now it's time to get into our main topic.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
So we're going to keep rolling with the prop discussion for our main topic of the show. But now we're going to talk about how to actually use these props and handouts in your game, working them into the story and ways to get started.
Yeah. So this is it's kind of like how to use them. When you make your props, I was just going to say it's kind of a good idea to think about, the rhythm of your story. Obviously, most of the props are going to come out in your investigation phase, and you'll probably start with those paper props. In written scenarios, it's already kind of laid out how to do that. But one of the things I recommend is to use a prop to kind of punctuate a single session. So it's kind of nice to bring a prop in at the end to draw in your players so that they have something to focus on, and then when they come back, they will pull that prop out and you'll have that experience. It's almost like, again, at the beginning of the next session. Oh yeah. Okay. Let's go back to the newspaper article. And then later on, you can bring in more advanced props if you have them. Idols and things like that. That's pretty advanced. Not everyone does that, but, you want to have kind of a progression.
Well, and that's where Sculpey comes in too. If you can't afford to buy some of the amazing idols that are available out there, you can always make your own. And that's a important thing to note is that, you know, if you are making your own, there's nothing wrong with that because in the mythos itself, it seems like every cult made their own idols. It's very rare to come across a cult who has inherited idols from somewhere else. It was typically all, you know, personalized, very personalized idols.
I love idols because it's like an interpretation of the thing. It's not the monster itself. Right. It's not like a mini, you know. It is this stylized interpretation. So it's sort of horrific because you look at, in reality, you know, there's Ganesh who actually has, you know, an elephant head.
Right.
There are all these gods that are actually, you know, these human hybrids. But then you look at Cthulhu and you're like, wow, did they worship octopi? Or, you know, there's this plausible deniability where you can actually say, well, that's an interesting cultural artifact. But it suggests a deeper, you know, terrifying monster that is only stylized and kind of, what should I say? It's like trimmed down version of what the real thing is. So you get like a glimpse in a way. You're getting like somebody's filter.
Yeah, with Cthulhu, because it's basically a dream vision of Cthulhu. So it's your interpretation of that vision, you know, in your dream. So, I mean, it's two or three levels removed, at least from the real thing, you know, I mean, if you're even taking the fact that it's a dream as being real, you know.
We went through a scenario recently that had a child's drawing as a prop. And again, that was like seeing the mythos through a child's eyes, which is, again, like a children often make monsters, you know, and right. So it's, you're kind of like, wow, that's really disturbing. Of course, there's that whole thing where kids, you know, kids who are abused often will draw, you know, terrible things, or if they're in wartime, they draw these terrible things. I actually think that's very creepy. It's also a reality that's kind of uncomfortable. But, you know, looking through a child's eyes, you know, then you have to interpret it as a clue. It's horrific. It's removed, you know?
Yeah, without a doubt. It can be extremely disturbing at times, you know, when you think of that. It's anything mythos-based seen through a child's eye seems to be more frightening in my experience.
Exactly. Yeah. So I just think bringing props into your game will, again, a signal to your players that you're serious, that you put in the work. I think that players appreciate that. And I think it helps engender, not just a passive style of play where they're showing up to be entertained. This signals to players that, we all should contribute, I think. I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, it shows, like you said before, it shows that you're serious about the game itself and that you've put a lot of time and effort into it. Because, I mean, if you've gone through the trouble of actually creating physical, manifestations of these props, you know, whether it be an idol or a paper prop or you know, maps or anything, or even so far as making, you know, your own bound Necronomicon, it shows that you're serious about the game in general. And generally, to a player, whenever you see a keeper whip this stuff out, you realize you're about to be involved in a really cool game.
Yeah.
Which really helps the atmosphere in general.
One of the things I noticed I did in a campaign, I had a journalist character in Kingsport, and there was an encounter and he decided he was going to write it up. But, you know, sort of in a couch it in more, he was going to interpret it, you know, and he was a yellow journalist, so he was not happy, not concerned about making stuff up. So anyway, I was like, hey man, that sounds awesome. Why don't you, between sessions, give me like 250 words of your write-up and send it to me? And I didn't tell him what I was going to do, but I then took that text. I found a typeface, a newspaper font on HPLS.com.
Right, they have some really good newspaper fonts there.
Totally. And then using their instructions, took newsprint. I went down to Utrecht Art Supplies and bought newsprint and took that to Kinko's. And I said, hey, I have a file that I want to print. You know, I laid it out. I actually asked them if I could use the Kingsport banner graphic that they had in a prop, and they were totally cool with that. So I don't want to say that they'll do that for everyone, but they're very happy to help people make props. And so I laid out these elements, had it in a PDF, and I said, is there any way to put this on newsprint? And they said, well, we have to cut this down because it's kind of a non-standard size newsprint. So they did it for me. And I had like a piece of newspaper. And on the back, HPLS also has ads, period ads that you can throw on. So I just had a bunch of ads, you know, for various ridiculous items. So, man, it looked like a cutting from a newspaper. I clipped it so it was only one column and had my player's text as a newspaper article and had that as a prop. So that, you know, that's a way to draw in your players in the prop making process. He was pretty, pretty shocked. And there was like a shift in the campaign at that point where people, I think, felt like, since I would go the extra mile, that I don't know. It's sort of set a tone.
Right. It kind of brings them forth to kind of go that extra step themselves as well as players.
We should also mention you don't have to go that, you know, you can make paper props without, you know, choosing your specific paper. Don't be afraid to just print out what's in the book and have those ready as props. It still has a great effect on regular white paper.
Oh yeah. You don't have to go all crazy. I mean, just the act of printing that crap out, you know, instead of, you know, just flipping through the book to the back of the book and showing them, okay, this is what you see. I mean, just having it all printed and ready ahead of time adds a huge flavor to it. And especially if you take the time to cut them out, a lot of times the handouts will actually have its own internal border on the page. And so you can print the page out as a whole, but then you can trim the excess, you know, the book's border itself out. So you lose the page number and the stuff like that at the bottom of the page.
or if it's multiple handouts on one sheet, you know, individually cut out each individual handout and then present those to the players individually. And that helps quite a bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to go crazy on it by any means. Any prop addition to a game is a huge addition.
Yeah, and the actual in-play effect is that you'll find evidence, like a newspaper article, and then later in the scenario, you will often kind of start to correlate the contents of your mind and be like, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't match the evidence we saw in the newspaper. Maybe we should go back and talk to the newspaper guy. But they have this physical thing that they can refer back to, so right. It's not all about remembering from session to session. They can actually look and say, oh, the guy's name is spelled differently here, or whatever it is that is kind of the embedded clue as you gather evidence.
Right. Or you find that, you know, in one article, which is the case that we came up with, you know, in one article, the newspaper article, a child is in one location. And then in the police report, the child is asleep. And so that you've got this dichotomy between the two, you know, props that we had that were given to us that we could, you know, glean information between them.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just good handout in general, or good handouts in general. But still, I mean, that's what they're there for. And it helps so much to be able to refer back to that as a physical copy instead of, you know, having to flip to the back of the book and re-present it every time that they want to reread it. Because eventually mm-hmm. they're going to not want to reread it.
Right, right. Yeah. But just having this kind of like dossier of evidence
right.
building.
Which is another funny thing, you should mention that. I actually ran a game once where we did that, where it was a Delta Green game. So you're playing an investigative character to start with. And essentially what they had done is we compiled a case file, you know, in game. So we had all of these different sources. We took our own notes, player notes that we took in character as character notes, which is really strange. It was like double notes removed. But we ended up compiling all these into a case file, for Delta Green. And then at the end of the scenario, we closed out the case file. Or in the case of, in this particular game, we died. And so our superior closed out the case file. so the prop took on its own, kind of its own life, outside of the game itself. And what the plan was to actually take that case file, and then reuse it in another scenario, because now we've ready made this prop, you know, in game, which was really cool. And then we could reuse that prop, you know, later on in different games.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I really want to try that again sometime, but it's hard because you don't have a physical group to do that, and it's almost a necessary thing.
Right, yeah, it really is something that bolsters the in-person play a lot more. I had my players collect the same kind of thing. It wasn't Delta Green, but there was this one private investigator, and he collected the props. Actually, a shout out to the Kingsport Historical Society group. But I had not really intended for you to keep those, but I'm happy to have you have them now. But he kept them in, kept kind of collecting them into a file. And at the end, he was like, well, I might use these in a future game. You know, like he could run, it was a 20s game. He said, well, if I run a modern game, any of these props could actually be used for keepering.
Right.
Which is kind of true. It's kind of nice to be able to leave a gift behind for your players.
Yeah, which is totally awesome. I mean, because then they have the seed that they can take to go and run their own games built off of yours. And it kind of extends out that whole Lovecraftian, you know, community driven mythos thing, which is really,
yeah, exactly.
really neat.
Absolutely.
So we want to hear from our listeners, and we have several methods to get in touch with us.
Our main contact email address is feedback@mu-podcast.com, and we have a Twitter account @mu_podcast. We have a Providence, Rhode Island voicemail number. That's 401-400-0MUP. That's 401-400-0687. Ask a question, leave us a liner, tell us who you are, and say, I'm enrolled at the Miskatonic University podcast, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fighting Cephalopods.
And our website is www.mu-podcast.com, and you can find our show notes for this episode at mu-podcast.com/24. That's the number 24.
Our 24/7 streaming content is available at mu-podcast.com/radio, and you can listen to individual show segments on demand over there.
Our forums are at mu-podcast.com/campus, and we also have a thread on the yogsothoth.com forums in the Mythophonia section, so please join us there as well.
Sign up for the show on iTunes, or you can use the RSS feed found on the website.
We're also on Stitcher Radio, so you can stream our shows whenever you like. Thanks for joining us for another episode. This was a short show because it was just the two of us, in case you haven't realized. So class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.
Hello and welcome to the Misk. First, let's open up the campus crier.
Oh no, that's wrong. It's
Miskatonic University campus crier. How may I help you?
Excellent.
This week we're going to wrap up our coverage of the 7th edition playtest with a discussion of this week.
Take two. No, it's like, settle down, class.
Oh, settle down, class. It's time for your lesson.
We should use that as the bumper. Exactly.
Right.
And our 24/7 streaming content is available at mu-podcast.com/radio. And you can listen to individual show segments over there.
You want to redo that one? He had a weird, like, cadence going on. It's very strange.
And our 24/7 streaming content is available at mu-podcast.com/radio. You can listen to individual show segments on demand over there.
That's Chad doing his amazing robot voice.
I'm actually doing the robot, the dance right now.
Oh, that's spectacular. Mr. Roboto, you go. Thanks for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
Do it again.
Thank you.
No, I don't care. I'm not editing it.
I don't give a shit either, so.
Dan's editing it, so.
It's gonna be a 10-minute edit for him, because we did pretty good. And we snapped a lot.
Yeah, maybe.
And our 24/7 streaming content is available at mu-podcast.com/radio. You can listen to individual show segments on demand over there.